Welcome to the Currency.News podcast. It pays to be curious.
In June 2024, John Moran became Ireland's first directly elected mayor in Limerick. It wasn't just a new role, it was kind of a political experiment. Limerick voters had approved by a very narrow majority, while elsewhere in Ireland similar proposals were rejected. Powers were being decentralised for the first time in the state. It was a test case. Moran, a high-profile former Secretary General of the Department of Finance and a former banker, ran as an independent and outflanked the political establishment. His election became the focal point. It was a test case for local democracy in Ireland. And from the start, it did not go smoothly. There was conflicts with councillors. There was clashes with senior officials. There was high-profile disputes. It begged a question. What was going on? Alan English, you're very welcome in the podcast studio here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Alan, over the last couple of months, you've spoken to more than 40 people.
More than that, actually. I've interviewed 40. I've spoken to many more, yeah.
To try and get to the bottom of what's going on, why there's so much conflict, why there's been so much aggro, for want of a better word, there. And over the next 3 days in The Currency, in your role as associate editor with The Currency, you're publishing a major landmark investigation into what's been going on, drawing from those 40 on-the-record interviews and vast more besides. And we just hope we'd sit down, bring you in here and talk to you about the story, why you took it on and what it means, I think, because this was seen as a test case for a country that had a very centralised government to decentralise some of that. But I'm going to begin with a slightly left-wing tangent.
Sure.
You're from Limerick.
I am.
You were the editor of the Limerick Leader for a long period, and you've got massive associations with Limerick. Must have been difficult to take on this sort of a project, given where you come from and your own background.
Yeah, it was. And I initially, while following the story very closely, Ian, I was steering clear of it journalistically. Because I just thought, I kind of knew that there was so much behind it. I knew it would be an extremely difficult story to tell. I knew that there were different narratives, contrasting, competing narratives. And I just thought sort of penetrating that that accusation and counter-accusation was going to be really difficult. But then, as I sort of kept following it, I my conscience was getting at me. I felt that I had an opportunity with The Currency, first and foremost, you know, as a news organization that encourages in-depth journalism. I had the opportunity to throw myself into it and to tell it in the kind of depth that I think it needs to be told, the only way it can be told. And I also had, you know, there was this almost a sense of civic duty. You referred to me being from Limerick. I felt that if I was well positioned to do this. I was editor of the Limerick Leader, as you said, for almost 10 years. I knew most of the dramatis personae, and I just felt, you know, just get on with it and get down to it and try and find the truth of what's going on here.
And let's talk about that. We don't want to give too much away. We want people to read it.
But, yeah, we do.
But to find that truth, and truth can be it's an unusual word because it's, you know, what is truth?
Yeah.
But to find it, and I know you wrote in part two about the challenge of locating it and the fog of conflict.
Yeah.
When in this investigation, it's been going on for months now, but when within that did you feel, actually, I have a grip on what's going on amidst the claims, the counterclaims, and the confusion?
I would say only in the last 2 weeks, Ian, and I've been interviewing people for this since early January, and quite truthfully, I just never felt comfortable that I had sort of nailed it in such a way that I felt that I could stand over it. You know, you'd been asking me, you know, very, very gently and very politely how I was getting on with the story, and I appreciated the patience. But I really felt that I needed to be comfortable that I could stand over what I was going to write, because I knew that, you know, there was a lot really riding on it, because there was people sort of telling me that this story needs to be told. And they were actually grateful that somebody had decided to give it the time to dig into it. But, you know, I kept doing interviews, and one time I thought, God, I have enough now. I mean, the amount of transcripts I have to do here is insane. But, you know, you lift up one rock and then you see something underneath and then you have to lift up another one. And then eventually, anyway, I got to a point, I'd say 2 weeks ago, where I thought, OK, I have enough.
But there is, and I'm going to come to kind of those interviews and stuff, but we might just give people a little sense of what to expect. Because, as I said, this was seen as a test case for local democracy. There was an election. John Moran was a very high profile and is a very high profile
indeed
figure. He went up against, you know, all of the political parties.
Yeah, 14 candidates, yeah.
It was covered in great depth, not at the extent of maybe a presidential election, but not far off at Allen at the time of the election. And things have just gone south. So there has been conflict, there has been disputes, and it doesn't seem to be going well.
Yeah, I mean, that's that. What you've just said there would be challenged by John Moran. His take on it would be that that this is politics and you're always going to get disputes, you're always going to get rows. And I think there's a certain amount of truth in that. But I think this also does go well beyond the norm in that you have a key relationship in the new legislation was the one between the former CEO, effectively the man that John Moran replaced, Pat Daly, and John Moran himself. You know, an absolutely fundamental working relationship. I can sit here today and tell you that relationship is dysfunctional. I've interviewed both men at considerable length. They're on the record. Pat Daly, for the first time, he doesn't hold anything back. Likewise, John Moran. So that's one aspect of it. There's also been extraordinary scenes in the council chamber in terms of people opposed to the way John Moran as mayor is going about his job. There's been a breakdown in relations between the senior members of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and John Moran. John Moran would characterise that, as would his supporters, of whom he has plenty in the council. They would characterise that as the old guard resenting the fact that there's a new sheriff in town and that the cosy arrangement, the so-called cartel that they previously enjoyed in the old regime, has been upended by his arrival. However, it's also the case, and I've asked enough people and spoken to enough people to be able to say this, that the work of the council has been hugely disrupted, and that a lot of progress around Limerick has been disrupted because people are in different camps over this. You know, there's the mayor's camp, there's the council's camp, there's people. There was a big row over J.P. McManus,
and I'll come to that in a minute.
Yeah. So there's a lot of And what I found as well when trying to report on this, Ian, was that, you know, all sides were very anxious to portray their version of events as the truth, you know. And on both sides of this argument, people were saying to me, you know, everybody can't be wrong. They sort of felt that everybody felt one way, and then on the other side, they felt the opposite. So it was difficult to try to navigate your way through all of that.
Yeah, he said, she said, we said, you know, black, white. Yeah. One of the things that kind of comes true from it is that for many of the people I think you spoke to, it was almost like a cathartic event.
Mm.
That there was a lot on their chest, and it was almost like a counselling session for them to get it off their chest.
Yeah, that absolutely was the case in interviews that running into double figures, I would say. There was initially a sense of caution, you know, God, this is such a hot potato. Or do I really want to sort of go on the record about this? But, you know, once I'd sort of persuaded them that I was intending only to be fair, to try and tell the story fairly, there was a unanimous view, really, that the story needed to be told, and they trusted me to tell it. And I appreciate the trust that people placed in me. And on many occasions I felt that they were just, the weight was coming off their shoulders as they were given a chance to talk about it. One of the interviewees, a counsellor with the Social Democrats, is a psychotherapist, and he said he's new to the council. On his very first day as a counsellor, he said he was screamed at, shouted at. He couldn't believe this. He said this was the most insecure workplace he's ever encountered, and he has worked a lot with children. And I asked him if he felt that some of the counsellors in the room were in need of therapy. And he didn't hesitate, absolutely, he said.
That's interesting. Listen, let's talk about the characters. If this is a drama, there's always characters. And there's some very interesting characters in it. You've got the main cast, but then you've got a very interesting
subplot
as well. Yeah, let's talk about the main cast first.
Yeah, sure.
So, John Moran, he's a very compelling character. You know, he was plucked to come into the central bank at the time of the financial crisis and then brought by Michael Noonan, another Limerick man,
indeed,
in a SecGen of the Department of Finance at a time where I think he was the first outsider ever to be appointed SecGen of any government department. And previous to all of that, he had ran a juice bar in France and he had been a serious banker. And the juice bar is just an aside, but a very serious character. A compelling character and an interesting candidate for the mayorship of Limerick in the first place.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I would say of the 15 candidates, he was the most eye-catching, for me anyway, looking at it, you know, from a journalistic perspective. He wasn't born in Limerick, but he moved here, I think, at age four from Birmingham. He's very much a proud Limerick man. And he had achieved great things. He's got a dazzling CV. I was well aware that, you know, he was very much associated with the backing the plebiscite for a Limerick mayor. And I would say he was probably the number one advocate and the most articulate advocate for a yes vote. So I wondered, you know, was he going to put himself forward? I remember meeting him on the day the vote passed and asking him the question straight out, and I got a non-committal answer. But I felt that that he absolutely was interested, and sure enough, he confirmed his candidacy, you know, several months before the election. And I think there was a lot of people there who sort of looked at the existing structure and felt, look, we need change here, you know, like what we have is all well and good, but Limerick needs something to push it further. We need a dynamic of change. And they didn't really feel, even though the big parties, you know, both ran or all ran, you know, vigorous campaigns, they didn't really put their trust in those. It came down to two independents, and there was a view that it needed an independent, you know, somebody who could sort of stand apart from the traditional system to run it. I thought John Moran ran by far, I would say, the best campaign. He had the most detail. He came with a manifesto that had a serious amount of work in it. He almost came ready to start on the first day, and I don't think that was the case with other candidates. So that's why ultimately I think people said, okay, this guy has got the track record, let's give him a go.
But that brings in itself its own problems.
Mm.
And I was trying to think about this as I was reading through your articles, Alan, and there's oftentimes you have a brilliant CEO, a chief executive of a business or a managing director, and then they go into the chairmanship of a business.
Mm.
And they find that movement very difficult because as CEO or as SecGen of the Department of Finance, you decide, you know, it's like, no, we're doing this, that or the other. You know, obviously a minister has a great input, but SecGens run departments on a daily basis, same way as a CEO would. And that sort of into virgin territory what a directly elected mayor looks like versus a CEO of a council. It's a difficult thing for a man who's used to running operations on a daily basis and getting his own way. It's just about that idea of a blind spot.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's a long-winded question.
No, I understand the question. And you know, it's a complicated scenario, Ian, in that the legislation, some people feel it's unclear and there are talks that it needs to be reviewed. But ultimately what you had was a very forceful and a man very, very confident in his own judgment. That would be a diplomatic way of phrasing it. Coming into a very traditional system. You know, as you said at the outset, this is the first time in more than a century that there has been any meaningful change to local government in Ireland in terms of additional powers, albeit not many. So you had a relationship that the legislators had drafted in a way that demanded the mayor and the CEO who became the director general in the new regime, demanded that they would work well together. And unfortunately, they haven't. One of the interviewees for this series put it well, I thought, when he said that this scenario demanded two people who could work in the grey, who could sort of said maybe look the other way sometimes and so on and so forth. He said Pat Daly, the CEO who became Director General, was a man who had spent his entire life living in the grey. And he said that John Moran was the most black and white man you will ever meet in your life. And my interactions with both men would back that up. And so you had a clash there of somebody who had been, as you say, used to getting his own way in the Department of Finance and was applying Department of Finance level scrutiny and expectation to a local organisation, and he was finding it wanting very, very quickly against the backdrop of having promised the people this is what he was going to deliver. Here's my plan. I am going to deliver this plan and I need the council executive to help me deliver it. And he felt that progress was slow and then he became started getting very impatient.
Okay, so that's John Moran. Pat Daly, yeah. Not a household name.
No, Pat Daly, not a household name. And there was a little bit of controversy in around Pat Daly some years back when he was appointed. He had previously been an executive with Shannon Development, which was ultimately, kind of wound up. And he was appointed to a role at Limerick City Council, City and County Council, where he served under the former CEO, Con Murray. Now, it's well known in Limerick that Pat Daly and Con Murray are friends. In fact, Pat Daly was the best man at Con Murray's wedding. Some controversy arose from that. There was an absolute insistence on Con Murray's part that he had played no part in the appointment of Pat Daly. But he ultimately winded forward to 2019. The plebiscite gets passed. Within days, Con Murray announces that he is departing his role as CEO at the end of his contract. And Pat Daly gets put in as interim CEO. Now, something very, very, very interesting happened, which people can read about in the series. We won't get into it here. But something very, very interesting happened, which basically upped the stakes and upped the ante big time in terms of the relationship between those two men.
So they're the two of the central protagonists. Mm. And we did say there was a subplot and they don't come any bigger than the uncrowned king of Limerick, J.P. McManus.
Indeed.
Who has a kind of a best supporting Academy Award nomination position within this drama.
Yeah, very much so. And the piece starts, it's a three-part series, very, very in-depth stuff. It starts with a scene in the council chamber last year when J.P. McManus became overcome and it went back to a controversy in which just as John Moran was coming into office, there had been an agreement that J.P. McManus was going to donate a building that had cost him $30 million to build. Opinion is divided on the building. My view is that it's an outstanding building of great architectural merit designed by Niall McLaughlin, one of Ireland's finest architects. It sits right in the heart of town and it was the home of the ill-fated and short-lived, unfortunately, international rugby experience. So it was clear that the numbers weren't really meeting expectations for that building, but J.P. McManus wanted to keep it open until such time as the Ryder Cup was open. The Ryder Cup is coming to Limerick in a day or in 2027.
Which J.P. McManus owns.
Which he owns, of course, yeah. And it's a huge thing for Limerick. So the idea was keep it open and then give it to the council under the proviso that they keep it open. At that point, then they could, if they didn't want to continue it as a rugby experience, they could make it a different type of museum or a civic.
Whatever.
The only thing was they couldn't sell it, Ian. They couldn't sell it. Okay. So the negotiations had been sort of going on. And then they sort of stalled. John Moran's view is that they were deliberately stalled because they were waiting for the new mayor to come in to ultimately make the decision. That is contested by Pat Daly. But between the jigs and the reels, what happened was John Moran, unlike any of the 14 other rivals he had for the mayoralty, looked under the bonnet and started scrutinising the terms of the deal. This is hotly contested again, but he basically came to the conclusion that the cost of keeping this museum open until 2027 was going to be excessive, and that it would ultimately take away from the council's ability to fund other projects, right? This was hotly disputed by the McManus team, and there was a lot of back and forth, but ultimately Moran was insistent that they shouldn't go ahead. That was his strong advice, and ultimately it was Pat Daly who advised the councillors, based on this new information allegedly, which was contested by the McManus team, not to go ahead. Okay, so they basically, there were other meetings, and JP McManus then withdrew the building. Okay, and the scene that I'm coming to, it happens the following year when there was a lot of hurt on the McManus side, and JP McManus was invited to come into the council chamber to basically set out his position.
And he did. And I was, sorry, I remember at the time, like, I was amazed he did. Not a man known, bar turning up at the horse races and saying, I'm delighted I won thanks to the jockey and whatever, and the trainer. He's not a man known for courting publicity or putting his head above the parapet.
Well, look, if you live in Limerick, you see more of him than you might think, Ian.
The year.
Well, yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. I hear you. That's true. However, look, he has been somebody who has, supported countless projects in Limerick.
And a great philanthropist.
Yeah, and was made a Freeman of Limerick in 2001, and holds Limerick very dear to his heart. You know, has financially backed the Limerick hurlers, and so on and so forth. Right. So clearly, McManus was hurting over this. I was astonished that this scene played out as well. I couldn't really see what the point of it was. But anyway, he arrived with three people. The meeting was behind closed doors. There were no journalists allowed in. The chamber was full. JP McManus had a statement. He proceeded to read some statement and barely got a couple of paragraphs into it when he just suddenly broke down, couldn't read any more. There was silence in the chamber. There was shock. He was comforted. He was, this is all described in the piece. He carried on after taking some time. And there was an enormous round of applause at the end of it. At which point then, there was sort of like the mayor wasn't there, okay? So the mayor was out of the country on business, and the mayor said that the meeting had been organized at a time when he wasn't available, and so on. But in the midst of all the shock, there were sort of people looking around, and a lot of people then decided that this was an opportunity to have a go at John Moran, and they sort of get up in the chamber and they say, this is a disgrace, where's the mayor? And then a lot of people who had been not really that interested in the Limerick experiment, as you put it, suddenly sort of sat up and said, Christ, what is going on in Limerick here? Like, you know, and I spoke to many people who were in the room. As I said, it was behind closed doors. But one of them said they were contacted by a friend of theirs in Cork who saw it in the news. And this person's quote was, "My God, Limerick is the only county in Ireland that can make its own billionaire cry." So it was an interesting part of the of the dynamic.
Just finally, some reflections. I mean, I said at the start, Alan, this was kind of an experiment in local government. I think one of the things that comes across quite clearly from the piece is how centralised Irish government is and has been for some time. We have councillors, but very little power. Obviously, county managers or CEOs, as they are now, have a lot of power. But at the same time, pretty much all of the power is vested in cabinet, not even in the Oireachtas, but vested in cabinet.
And also, but also vested in the civil service, and that's a key point, you know.
Yeah. So just reflections upon this three-part series, beyond the characters and the subplots, which we'll get into in the three-part series, but reflections upon what it says about this local government experiment and experience.
I think it's right in the melting pot. I think a lot of people are dismayed at how it's going. However, I think it can be rescued. I would be optimistic by nature, Ian. And I've spoken to enough people to come to the belief that there is a desire to get this thing sorted out. Dublin has sort of stayed away from it, really, and there's been conflicting messages as to whether there's supposed to be a review or will there won't be a review. And I think there needs to be some responsibility taken at national level. Ultimately, it was the national government that put this in. I also think, you know, people need to look at themselves in Limerick. I have very, very clear ideas on that, and I set them out in part three of the piece. But I think it's also not untypical that something like this, when it's introduced for the first time, becomes divisive. And there are examples around the world of when directly elected mayors have been introduced. The idea that it goes swimmingly at the start, and maybe that's something that people can't really see when they're in the middle of it all, isn't the case. You know, there are nearly always fights, and typically what happens is people get over it and people get used to the idea.
They work out a relationship of how these things work.
Yeah. But it's right there at the moment, and there's massively contrasting styles. Some people are saying that John Moran needs to compromise. John Moran has a different view on that, which I explore. I interviewed John Moran for 7 hours, by the way. You know, there's a lot in this.
Very good. Well, Alan, it's a brilliant piece of journalism. I commend it to people's attention. And part one goes live tomorrow morning. So thanks very much for joining me in studio.
Thanks very much, Ian.
You've been listening to the Currency.news podcast. It pays to be curious.